7. Marcus looked around the shabby tent tavern, one of many that had sprung up in the refugee camp. He hadn't been to this particular establishment before, but he'd seen many like it in his day. Admittedly, few of them had been quite this squalid. The canvas of the tent was sloppily patched with tar, rather than being properly repaired. The floors, which could at least have been swept smooth and laid with rushes, were simply mud. The legs of the trestle tables had sunk 6 inches into it, and their surfaces would have been too low if the benches in front of them hadn't sunk down as well. Marcus stared at the mug in front of him. The beer had chunks of something floating in it, probably grain from the fermenting pots, but one could never be sure. It didn't smell like beer should. It smelled something like dirty water, only not as pleasant. He'd paid for it with a silver bull, and the copper rams he'd gotten back had been shaved so badly that the horns on the inscribed side were almost completely gone. It was intriguing, in a way. The refugee camp had done what hardship always did to people. In some of them it brought out a greatness of spirit that was almost unbelievable. Fidelius had seen men with next to nothing literally give cold children the cloaks off their backs. He'd seen families with barely enough food to survive take in one more homeless child, find a way to stretch a blanket over one more freezing body. He'd seen legionaries of the First Aleran, sickened by the suffering they'd seen while on drill, take their pay directly to market, spend it all on food, and take it to the camp to be given to those who needed it. In others, though, it brought out the worst. He'd led squads that buried the corpses of people who'd been killed for their threadbare cloaks and the rags they'd had wrapped around their feet. He'd seen men demanding things of women in lieu of money, seen those who had what others needed demand degradation and humiliation from them before they would share it. He'd seen the bruises and broken bones that had come as the result of fear and frayed tempers. The sickness brought on by exposure and too little food, even here, in the gentlest lands of the realm. And all of it, all of that sad, pitiable, loathsome humanity began to clot together somehow, to become a near visible vapor, a stench in the air that smelled like... well, it smelled like this beer. Marcus pushed his mildewed wooden mug away a little and did his best to ignore the smell. Then he took the little fury lamp from his pouch, murmured it to life, set it out on the rough table, and waited. The washerwoman entered the nameless tavern and paused in the doorway before looking around. It was dark enough inside that his little lamp served as a beacon for her gaze, and she crossed the rough floor to sit down at the table with him. "Good day," the disguised Lady Aquitaine said. She glanced around the tavern with a sniff. "I always knew you were a secret romantic." Marcus nudged the mug toward her.
"Thirsty?"
She glanced at the mug, turned a shade paler, and gave him a level look.
"Suit yourself," he said.
"Why here?" she asked him.
"No one will recognize me here."
"I almost didn't recognize you." Marcus shrugged.
"No armor. Different cloak. My hood is up. I look like everyone else."
"We could have met anywhere," she countered. "Why here?" Marcus glanced up and met her eyes.
"Maybe I wanted you to see it."
The washerwoman tilted her head slightly to one side. "See what?" He moved his hand in an all-encompassing gesture.
"The consequences."
She lifted both eyebrows sharply.
"A lot of times, people who make big choices never have to see what can happen. All of this, and worse than you see here or what you saw on the way here, it's the result of choices like that."
She stared at him without expression for a long moment. "This is supposed to horrify me."
"This? This is nothing," Marcus replied. "This is what happens when there's a polite disagreement, which is more or less what we've had with the Khanim so far. This is what happens when everyone has to tighten their belts a little, but there's still enough to go around. It's worse in the south. Rampant disease, starvation, brigands looting mercenaries, men taking more liberties, men seeking vengeance for the same."
He nodded at the tavern. Outside the damp, stinking canvas, someone with a wet cough was wheezing for breath between fits of hacking spasms.
This is sunshine and sweetbread compared to what could happen.
Lady Aquitaine narrowed her eyes. If my husband and I continue in our designs, you mean?
I'd have to know them all, Marcus replied, and I'm sure that I don't. So it's for you to say.
One of the things I have always admired about you is your professionalism. This isn't like you. Marcus shrugged.
It's a secure enough meeting space. I had something to say to you. I said it. What you do with it is up to you.
Lady Aquitaine frowned. She glanced around the shabby tavern for a few seconds, then she shook her head briskly, took the mug, and emptied its contents onto the floor. She put the mug firmly back on the table. Keep your focus on the task at hand.
I would, if he could be bothered to arrive on time.
She shrugged. He's used to being the most important person around. Important people are always late to meetings.
Why tolerate it? Marcus asked.
I need him, she said simply.
What happens when you don't?
She gave him a little smile. He'll have the opportunity to learn better working habits. Just then the tavern's entrance cloth swung to one side again, and half a dozen people entered, cloaked, all of them obviously together and too well-dressed for the neighbourhood. Marcus sighed. The worst thing about his departure from the Cursors had been the lack of competent professional associates. One of the cloaked figures turned to the surly-looking man behind the cheap wooden table that passed for a bar. She lifted her hands to her hood and lowered it, revealing her features. Marcus tensed slightly as he recognized Phrygia Navaris. Navaris flung a small leather pouch. It struck the barman in the chest, bounced off, and landed on the grimy bar. She fixed the man with a flat, grey stare and said, "Get out." Marcus could have made the same threat, the same way, but the man would have counted the money first. Marcus didn't blame the barman for taking the purse and departing without bothering to so much as glance inside. The shortest of the figures looked around for a moment, then hurried to the table and sat down opposite Lady Aquitaine. He sat on his cloak, pulling the hood tight, and he muttered in irritation, glancing around the tent before he flung it back.
"There's discretion," Senator Arnus muttered, "and then there's senseless paranoia. Did we have to meet in this sty?"
"Now, now, be nice, Arnus," Lady Aquitaine said. "It smells just as bad on this side of the table, I assure you." Marcus watched the senator's singulares. Navaris remained by the entrance, looking at nothing and displaying all the emotion of frozen granite. The other four fanned out around the room, dividing their attention between the easily opened canvas walls and the people sitting at the table. Marcus noted the weapons belted at one man's hip, and the bow one of the others bore in a slender hand. Then he focused on Arnus again. The senator was, in turn, staring hard at Marcus.
"Take your hood off," Arnus snapped. "I think not," Marcus said.
Arnus smiled. It reminded Marcus of a snarling jackal.
"Take it off now!"
"No."
"Navaris," Arnus said, "if he does not remove his head from the hood, you are to take both from his shoulders."
"Yes, sir," Navaris said.
She never moved her feet or looked toward Marcus, but her hand had drifted to the hilt of her sword. Lady Aquitaine made an impatient sound and flicked a hand. The air suddenly took on the tight, somewhat muffled feeling of a wind crafting meant to prevent any eavesdroppers from listening to a conversation.
"Arnus, restrain yourself. His hood stays where it is."
"Why?" "Because you're a brilliant politician, Senator," Marcus replied. "But you're a novice conspirator. I am currently in a position of extreme value. If you are allowed to know who I am, your incompetence will undoubtedly send the entire plan to the crows."
Arnus's mouth dropped open and hung there for a moment. Marcus took the opportunity to savour the look on the fool's face.
"Indelicately put," Lady Aquitaine said, giving Marcus an arch glance. "But essentially accurate." She held up a mollifying hand. "You're a politician and strategist, Arnus. Not a spy. If we were all equally skilled at everything, there'd be no need for alliances, would there?"
The senator's face flushed dark crimson. "And this one? What skills does he bring to the table?" "I know things, Senator."
Arnus lifted his chin.
"Such as?"
"That you have a talent for finding capable employees, for one," Marcus said. He nodded at one of the hooded men on guard.
"Aresius Flavus,
twice champion of the Winter's End arms tournament in Alera Imperia, the man who killed the current High Lord of Rhodes' elder brother in a fair duel on the lawn outside the Grey Tower. The young woman watching the door is, I believe, Iris the Hawk. She was quite famous for her archery along the shield wall and happened to slay half a dozen of Lord Calaris's immortal assassins while protecting Lady Voria on the night of the Red Stars. Lady Voria was the only survivor of the attack on her guest house." The cloaked figure by the door turned to stare at Fidelius. Then she nodded briefly. He nodded back to her. "The man at the rear wall is called Tandus. He's a mute. He's served in half a dozen different legions as both a Knight Ferris and Knight Terror. He's famous for single-handedly storming the gates of Lord Gardas's stronghold when Gardas abducted some freeman's daughter. He killed 30 men, taking her back." Lady Aquitaine's gaze never left the senator's face, but her quiet smile slowly grew.
"And him," Marcus said, nodding to the last man, the one nearest the table. "Rivar Arminius. He's young, a knight heiress and ferris, and claims to have the fastest sword arm in Alera. He's won 11 duels against established teaching masters, 9 of them fatal."
Arminius's cloaked figure turned toward them briefly. Then he drew the hood back from young, handsome features and said, 10. Maestro Piter took a lung fever of his injuries." Marcus inclined his head slightly. 10. He turned his gaze to the last member of the senator's singulares.
"And, of course, Phrygia Navaris. One of the more dangerous professionals alive. Utterly reliable. Provided she does not lose her temper."
Navaris's hand continued slowly stroking the hilt of her blade. Arna stared venomously at Marcus. He folded his hands on the table, lips pressed into a thin line.
"I'm not moving ahead blind, my lady. Show me this man's face."
"Or what, Arnus?" Lady Aquitaine asked, her voice almost poisonously reasonable. "You'll walk away?"
"Why wouldn't I?"
"Perhaps because I know what happened to the first captain appointed to the first senatorial. His name was Argavus, I believe. So odd that he vanished the night before you marched." Lady Aquitaine's gaze drifted to Navaris. "It would be a shame if someone mentioned the location of the body to the Civic Legion. An investigation might turn up all sorts of unpleasant facts."
Arnus shrugged, unfazed. "I've endured investigations before. Tiresome, but I manage."
"Yes. It's easier to pass the time when one has so many appetites to indulge." Her eyes shifted back to Arnus, and despite the worn exterior she had adopted, her smile turned sultry, predatory. "I can't help but wonder how often you've endured the wrath of a jealous husband. You do remember the wreckage at the piers 4 years ago?" The blood drained from Arnus's face.
"You wouldn't."
"It's a card I'll only get to play once. I'd prefer not to use it on you, dear Arnus." Her gaze was unwavering. "You are, of course, welcome to unleash your hounds, if you think it might do you any good." Marcus already had a knife in either hand under his cloak. He'd take the senator himself and then Arminius, the cutter standing closest to the table. Whatever Lady Aquitaine did, it would be violent and best used against the more distant opponents, so he would handle those nearest. He was sure she'd be thinking the same thing.
Granted, he wasn't nearly as quick as he had once been. Arnas wouldn't pose a problem, but the young duelist might well prove more formidable. Marcus was certain that he'd have had little chance against the young cutter in a fair fight. It was the main reason he avoided them wherever possible. Arnas was silent for a long minute, his forehead beaded with sweat, and the tension in the room grew. Then the senator looked away, chin lifted haughtily. "It's senseless to bicker at this point, dear Invidia, when there is so much work to be done." A small smile graced her mouth. "I'm glad we agree." Marcus tried not to exhale visibly in relief, and slipped the knives away again.
"I've ordered the legions to march forth against the Khanim. What do you see as our next step?"
"Rufus Scipio," she said. "He's dangerous." Arnas arched an eyebrow.
"You can't be serious. He's little more than a boy. A good showman for his men. Tremendously lucky to be in the right place at the right time. Nothing more."
"I'm less concerned with what he is than what he might become. Mistakes happen, Arnas, but it's best if he's gone before the legions march. Can you see to it this time?" At the shabby bar, Navarus's fingers began caressing the hilt of her blade.
"My lady," Marcus said, "if I may."
She glanced at him, eyebrows lifting again.
"Speak."
"It's too late for something that direct," Marcus said. "There's already been one approach. It's failed. He's on his guard, as are his men. A second attempt now could be turned back upon us."
Lady Aquitaine grimaced and nodded.
"Your suggestion?"
Marcus spoke carefully, keeping his tone absolutely level, neutral.
"The Legion's loyalty is what makes him a threat to your plans. Remove him from the Legion and you remove his ability to disrupt events in any meaningful way."
"I can't simply strip him of command," Arnas replied. "Not without cause."
"Thus far," said Lady Aquitaine, "he's been clever enough to resist manipulation."
"It won't be difficult," Marcus said. "It's simply a matter of knowing where to apply the pressure."
Chapter 8. It never occurred to Amara that she might have trouble keeping up with anyone when it came to flying. After all, no one she'd ever seen, not even High Lady Aquitaine, had been more swift or nimble than she in the air. Amara had won race after race during her days at the Academy. She'd never been overmatched in aerial battle. But then she had never tried her skills against the First Lord of Alera. Within the first few minutes, Gaius had surged steadily ahead of her, even as a cold north wind began propelling them southward with mounting speed. Gaius had swiftly ascended to above the cloud cover, and it was as well he did. Within an hour she could barely keep sight of the First Lord, even with Cirrus to help her. Amara poured on all the speed she could, and for a time she closed the distance inch by inch, but only for a time. Then she rapidly made headway on the First Lord, until she was keeping pace only a dozen yards behind him. Amara felt gratified at her ability to keep up with him. It was only then that she realized that Cirrus's strength was being bolstered by that of dozens of smaller wind furies she could just barely sense. By the time the sun had passed its zenith, she had come to the grudging realization that in this particular kind of travel at least, Gaius's raw power quite simply trumped all of her innate talent for flight and her hard-won skill. He never flagged either, but kept the pace with grim determination. Only a few times did Amara get a glimpse of the ground below, and each time she did, it was sliding by much more rapidly than it should have, especially at their altitude. The wind at their backs only grew swifter, and Amara realized that Gaius had summoned forth one of the great wind furies of the far north to speed their way, with what could only be unpleasant consequences for the northernmost cities and towns of Alera, who must have received a fresh blast of Arctic cold just as winter began to loosen its grip. Amara had no way to judge where they were, especially given that she had no idea precisely where they were going beyond south. She rarely got a chance to look for any landmarks that might tell her where they were headed. The First Lord, however, seemed to have no such trouble finding his way, and his flight was smooth and relentless.
By the time the sun set, Amara had no more energy to spare for such thoughts. It was all she could do to maintain the focus she needed to stay aloft. Still, Gaius flew on, never wavering, never slowing, as if he had become some implacable extension of the north wind itself. Night fell, and Amara had no idea how she managed to stay in the air. She remembered being terribly cold, hungry beyond words, and weary to the point of pain. At last the dark shadow of the First Lord, now only a black shape against the stars, began to descend. Somehow Amara managed to keep up with him as they plunged into more cloud cover and came out the bottom of it into a fine, cold, misty rain. They slowed as he banked around some rolling feature of terrain, and then she saw a dim light beneath them, among thick trees hung with long, long streamers of some kind of green-yellow moss. Amara remembered setting down among those trees, near a fire that had burned down to a bed of red-orange coals and tiny flickers of flame, giving off the absolute minimum amount of light. She remembered her legs almost buckling from beneath her as she touched down. Gaius turned to find her standing behind him, if barely, and a look of concern crossed his face. Then he took her arm and guided her to the fire. There was a bedroll there, placed not far from the fire, with a large stone propped up behind the blankets to catch the heat and reflect it back, and Amara nearly whimpered in relief at the sudden warmth. Then someone pressed a tin mug of hot soup into her hand, and she gulped it down as quickly as she could without burning herself. After that she remembered thinking how heavenly the bedroll felt beneath her, and merciful dark closed on her. She woke some time later. It was morning. Golden sunlight flickered down through a white haze overhead, only occasionally letting a shaft of glowing morning sweep over the ground. There was green all around. So much green, in so many shades, that she wondered why on earth anyone thought a simple word like green could adequately describe them all. It took her a moment to focus her eyes and sort out her surroundings. Forest. Thick, thick forest. Some of the trees were ancient giants, whose trunks were broader than she was tall. Many were smaller, clawing for space and sunlight in the shadows of their larger neighbors. Thick brush grew up everywhere, largely soft-looking fronds and ferns. Hanging moss draped off of everything more than a few feet above the forest floor. She had never seen any place quite like it, and yet she had the sense that there was something very familiar about it. Birds sang, but few of them sounded like those she knew. She lay quietly for a moment, taking in the details. A few insects buzzed here and there. She saw a motion in a nearby tree, and saw a shadowy, nebulous form, a wild wood fury doubtless, vanish among the branches. She pushed herself up to find Gaius sitting on a stone beside the fire. He had discarded his usual silks of scarlet and blue for a woodsman's tunic and breeches, and he looked surprisingly comfortable in them. He sat with a mug in his hands, his eyes closed, his head tilted up.
"Good morning, Countess," he murmured.
"Sire," she said, "I apologize for last night. I should not have collapsed on you like that."
"On the contrary," Gaius said. "That's the first time anyone's kept any kind of pace with me since I took Septimus to—"
He broke off suddenly, eyes blinking open, and stared up at the sky.
"I had expected to carry you the last few hours."
"You did have to help me," Amara said. He shrugged a shoulder.
"I was helping myself, Countess. You simply stayed close enough on your own merits to take advantage of it. We made better time than I dared to hope."
She rose and stretched. "Where are we?"
"The western reaches of the Weeping Hills."
Amara frowned. That's in Kalare's territory, isn't it?"
"At its fringes, yes," Gaius said. "Though very few folk live in this area, and the land between where we stand and the sea is all wilderness. In fact, I doubt that there are any living souls except ourselves within 40 or 50 miles, if that.
We are some 300 miles southwest of the city of Kalare itself. Tea?
Please.
Amara accepted the mug he poured for her from a tin pot hung beside the fire. It felt good beneath her chilled fingers, and she sipped at it very slowly. 300 miles?
Yes. And I'm afraid we walk from here.
Amara felt her eyebrows go up.
Sire?
It's the only way.
Gaius gestured at the fire beside him.
Sit, sit. I'll explain.
Amara settled down by the fire and took stock of the camp. There was evidence of a small but complete amount of field gear. Bedrolls, cooking utensils, a small set of tools, and what looked like an emergency tent. Gaius must have had it waiting here for them.
We're going to Kalare,
Gaius said.
Sire?
Amara frowned down at her tea. I don't understand. The legions in the field are going there too. Gaius shook his head.
They're fighting a campaign to get there. This isn't the same thing at all. I don't need to fight for the territory. I simply need to be there.
Why not just fly in?
Gaius shook his head.
Kalaris has been clever. He must have been planning for this since he first succeeded to the title. His network of watch furies is extensive to the point of insanity.
Amara frowned. Watch furies? I don't understand.
Furies tasked to react to a particular presence. In this case, my own. If I come within 300 miles of Kalare in the air, he'll know it.
Can't you just remove them?
Of course, Gaius said. But their sudden silence would warn him of my presence very nearly as effectively as if they started screaming about me. I can only imagine that maintaining such a network is a constant irritant. Likely it's a reflection of his personality. Paranoid, damnably paranoid, obsessive, formidable.
Amara nodded.
I don't understand, then, what we're doing here.
There's a flaw in Kalaris's planning, Gaius said. He'll see any approach from the air. But on the ground, all of his furies are geared to keep watch for me by means of being on the lookout for my furies. My power.
Gaius glanced up at her.
So I'm borrowing a page from our young captain. I'm walking in. No crafting. Kalaris will not expect that. He would never do such a thing, not in 1,000 years, and he is blind to anything that isn't himself.
Amara began to speak, then frowned and sipped at her tea instead, thinking over her words.
Sire, she said after a moment, that's a long walk.
A very long walk.
Particularly
for
a man my age.
The First Lord said, his rich voice amused.
Yes, I'm aware.
He glanced back at the low fire and his smile faded.
But it must be done.
Amara shook her head.
But why, sire? What do you hope to accomplish?
I'm going to break Kalaris's power, Countess. I'm going to end his ability to continue his rebellion.
How?
He shook his head.
That is something I'm keeping to myself for now. Suffice to say that there are greater and subtler matters of Furycraft than those such as Kalaris and I prefer not to make widely known. This touches upon such a matter.
But,
Countess, Gaius said quietly, are you with me? Or not?
She grimaced and glared at the fire.
Of course I am.
Good. Your only concern is to help me get to Kalare. I won't be able to use any of my own Furycraft without alerting Kalaris to my presence, which is to be avoided. I'm going to be relying upon you, Amara, to handle any problems that arise.
Amara felt both her eyebrows go up.
Sire, I'm not incompetent in the field, but it is hardly my forte. I'm not at all sure that I'm the best person for this kind of job.
I trust you, the First Lord said simply.
She felt a flush of pride and pleasure at the words.
but she shook her head.
"Then you should trust my advice, sire. I'm not the one you should have with you."
"I should attempt it alone."
"No," she said at once, somewhat alarmed. "No, sire. I don't see why you should be trying to do this at all. But if you must do it, there are those better qualified to help you."
"The larger our party is, the more attention it is going to attract."
There was no arguing with that.
"But, sire..." "Enough," Gaius said. "Countess, there are very few people in this world who are worthy of trust. Of those who are, not nearly enough of them are on my side. You're one of those few. I trust your loyalty. I trust your skill. I trust your judgment. In my eyes, that makes you one of the only people even remotely qualified for such a task."
"But there's only me, sire," she said. "And I'm not sure I'll be nearly enough. I can only be in one place at one time, have my eyes on one problem at a time. And my crafting skills are not the most advantageous when it comes to this kind of travel."
Gaius set his mug aside and rose.
"Ah, now there is a point upon which there can be no argument. But I'm afraid I had very little selection in the matter. There was you, and perhaps one other."
The First Lord gave her a brief sunbeam flicker of a smile and said,
"I'll stretch my legs a bit. We have a little time."
Amara stared after him for a moment before she suddenly recognized what had felt so familiar about this place. She rose and paced over to the bedroll where she had slept and bent down, lifting the blankets to her nose and inhaling. The brush rustled gently behind her, and Amara's heart started beating very quickly.
"Good morning," a deep voice rumbled from behind her. "Nice day for a walk."
Amara turned. A tall, broad-shouldered man came out of the thick forest bearing a pair of freshly caught fish. He was dressed in a forester's brown-green cloak, stone-grey tunic and brown leather breeches. He carried a hunting bow in his left hand, and Amara could see the handle of an axe hanging from a strap over one shoulder. He smiled, teeth flashing, and tossed the bow to one side.
"Bernard," she said, and went to him. She wrapped her arms around his neck, pulled him down to her, and kissed him soundly on the mouth.
He slid an arm around her waist and pulled her hard against him, returning the kiss with single-minded intensity. The kiss was so sweetly delicious that it seemed to blind Amara as her fingers slid through his dark hair and as her body suddenly caught fire at the touch of his hands, his mouth.
"Thought you'd appreciate a big breakfast after a long flight," he murmured against her mouth. "I'll cook these for you, if you're hungry."
Amara drew slowly back from him and met his eyes.
"I'm starving," she said quietly.
"You can cook the crow-begotten fish after." Sudden hot fire danced in the back of his eyes, but he affected a puzzled tone.
"After what?"
She snarled at him, though she knew her own smile would give it the lie, knocked the string with the fish out of his hands with one of hers, then twined her fists in his tunic. She stepped into him as she put a leg behind his own, pushing. He was too quick for her, turning her motion against her, and she let herself fall, his body coming down to pin hers against the earth. His mouth found hers again, and she felt herself arch up against him, hips rolling, her body demanding more. He broke the kiss, his breath broken into rough gasps.
"Oh," he growled quietly. "After that..."
Amara let out a wicked little laugh that broke off as her husband kissed her again, and she returned it with breathless ardour.
Chapter 9. Tavi focused on the stone in the dale outside the town of Elenarch, blocking out absolutely everything else around him. Nothing existed but himself and the stone, a wind and rain-rounded lump of granite the size of a handcart. He breathed deeply, concentrating, then spoke in a clear and commanding voice.
"Come forth!"
Nothing in particular happened. Frustration welled up inside him.
a red bubble expanding in his chest. He fought it off, concentrating on his breathing, on his focus, and addressed the stone again, reaching out for the fury he knew was inside.
"Come forth!"
The stone's stillness and silence were nothing short of insulting.
"Crows, take it!"
Tavi snarled. He clenched his teeth, tried to keep his tone of voice level and confident, and only mangled the words slightly as he gave it one last try. He wasn't sure exactly what tipped him off. There might have been the faintest hint of sound behind him. There might have been a breath of excitement and feline amusement that ran over the back of his neck. It could have been the subtle singing tension that he now felt surrounding every blade. Likely it was a combination of all of those subtle factors. They coalesced into a single thought that flashed into the front of his mind. Danger. Tavi flung himself to one side, drawing his blade as he went. He whirled on the way, spinning back toward the attacker, his back to the ground, and his blade intercepting a sword descending in a sharp overhand arch. The two blades met, and there was a small explosion of golden green sparks. Tavi's momentum carried him forward, and his bare shoulder blades hit the grass first. He drew upon the wind blowing through the little vale to give speed enough to fold his body into a ball, bounce a bit off the grass, and then roll back onto his feet. He wobbled but caught his balance as a rock the size of his head came zipping at his face. Off balance, he had no time to move, and instead thrust the heel of his hand forward, drawing strength from the earth, and struck the oncoming stone with a single sharp blow. The rock exploded into shards and dust. Flying pieces lashed open half a dozen small wounds on his naked upper body and put two new rips in his trousers. His wrist and hand hurt like the crow's, but he still had his balance, and as his attacker darted forward with wind-crafted speed, he met a blindingly swift stroke of his attacker's sword with his own. He traded three or four strokes running on pure reflex, the blows too swift to allow for any thought, many cascades of sparks scattering around him with each blow. He never saw the opening in his opponent's defense so much as he felt it, sensed the change coming in the humming sensation of the two swords' furies clashing and blending. He twisted his blade forward in a serpentine thrust, forcing his opponent's blade to engage his, the tip too far to one side to stop him from stepping in close, locking his aching left hand on his opponent's weapon wrist and applying the pressure of a fury-assisted grip.
"Ah!"
Kitai cried out, the sound both pained and amused.
"Enough, enough!"
Tavi released her wrist, and the Marat girl lifted her blade in a quick salute, then sheathed it one-handed in a single motion, never bothering to look down at the scabbard.
"That was cheating," Tavi said. "I was trying to concentrate."
Kitai thrust out her lower lip in a pouting expression.
"Poor Aleran, needing all his rules to keep him safe."
Tavi swiped a hand at her. Kitai laughed and ducked it.
"Crows, Kitai, you know how hard I've been working. Until I can bid a fury to manifest..."
She threw her hands up in the air.
2 years ago, he has no furies at all, and he is content. Today he has more than he ever hoped to have, and it is not enough."
Tavi growled and shoved his own sword away, also without looking. He couldn't have explained how he did it. He could feel when the tip of his blade was aligned with the metal fittings at the end of the scabbard, a sensation that was comparable to feeling his fingers all in the proper position to tug on a glove.
"I'm not going to get opportunities to practice once we march. You know that. This was my last chance to try it for a while."
"And you tried it," Kitai said.
She put a hand on her hip and faced him, her green eyes hard.
"It didn't work, and you started to lose your temper, at which point it wasn't going to work."
Her expression softened slightly.
"You were only torturing yourself, Chala."
She was right, Tavi thought,
which was annoying, but he could feel her genuine concern for him, sense it almost as if it were an emotion of his own.
His watercrafter's perceptions were still inconsistent and often quite vague, but where Kitai was involved, they were clear and unmistakable. Or perhaps the bond they shared was more responsible for the empathy that had grown between them. He wasn't sure.
Kitai studied him, bright green eyes on his, and shook her head. You think too much, Alaron. Always planning, always questioning, always calculating. It's a wonder your head doesn't catch fire from inside.
She glanced up at the sun, then down at the cuts on his chest.
Come, let me clean that up. He'll be here in a moment.
Tavi blinked and looked down at himself. He had almost forgotten the injuries. He had shut away the pain almost before it had registered on him, and had been holding it away without really thinking about it. Once he did, of course, the crafting faltered, and the cuts burned and stung unpleasantly. Kitai brought a cloth and a flask of water and cleaned the cuts and scrapes. Tavi managed to hold still through it all, though it was hardly pleasant. He had to close his eyes and exhale slowly as Kitai cleansed one cut. The Marat girl winced a little and leaned down, placing a gentle kiss nearby the hurt. Then she bound over the two wounds that still oozed a little blood, her motions practiced. They should be, Tavi thought. Great Furies knew that they'd had enough practice on one another over the past 2 years. Tavi had just pulled his shirt back on when Enna's horse came walking slowly through the entrance to the dale. The horse trooper had one hand clamped resolutely over her eyes.
"Captain," she called. "Kitai told me not to look at you when you were unclothed. How am I supposed to know whether or not you are unclothed without looking?"
Tavi gave Kitai a level look. "Oh, for pity's sake." She laughed at him. She did that quite often, Tavi thought. The smile that went with the laugh was devastating, and he found himself smiling with her, despite another day's effort, another day's failure.
"It's all right, Anna," Tavi called. "You can look."
"Thank goodness," Anna said, dropping her hand and beaming at Tavi. Then she gave him a disappointed little frown and sighed. "I miss all the best parts."
"Centurion," Tavi prompted.
She gave him a quick salute.
"The man who none of us saw and who none of us are going to remember is here to see you, sir."
"He knows me," said a young man's voice, and Aaron walked around from behind Enna's horse, touching the animal's flanks gently with one hand as he brushed past. He was small, quite a bit under 5.5 feet tall, but the reed-thin young man Tavi had met when he first came to the academy had hardened. Aaron, sandy-haired and unassuming, was still slender, but slender like hunting cats or dueling swords, rather than like writing quills. He was dressed in a rough garb of castaway clothing, most of it ill-fitting, and looked like any of 10,000 refugees in the camps. At a nod from Kitai, Enna withdrew. Tavi went to the young man and traded grips with him, then considered his clothing with a frown.
"Aaron, I never said I was sending you out again."
"Please," Aaron said. "I'm a professional spy, Tavi. I wouldn't be doing you any good standing around here."
He turned to Kitai with a smile and bowed gallantly over her hand.
"Not that it isn't nice, sleeping with both eyes closed, but I'm starting to get soft."
"You've only been back for 3 days," Kitai said.
"That's just about enough," Aaron said.
He lowered his voice conspiratorially and jerked his head covertly at Tavi.
"I can't stand working where my superiors can look over my shoulder anyway."
Tavi smiled, but he didn't really feel it. Aaron had worked his way into position in Khanim-occupied territory over an entire perilous year. Some of the Khanim commanders had spent a great deal of energy hunting for spies and rooting them out. Many such informants had been caught and had not been seen again. Aaron had, Tavi gathered, very nearly been caught as he left occupied territory, and there was a fresh scar on his brow that he had not explained.
"Is there any word from the First Lord?" Tavi asked quietly.
Aaron shook his head.
"You haven't given me enough time to try all the channels."
"I don't have the time," Tavi said. "We march tomorrow."
"I know," Aaron said. "But word is that Gaius is with the legions in the south somewhere. As far as anyone I could reach knows, all of his messages are being routed to someone on the staff. even cursor traffic. So either he's come down with a bad case of bureaucratic thinking, or he's up to something, Tavi said.
Crows. Why now?
Even if he wasn't, Aaron said. From what you told me, he's given you your marching orders. Maybe you shouldn't be trying to go over Arnas's head like this.
That was before we knew about Mastings, Tavi said, or Arnas's so-called battle plan, or what he had in mind for the non-combatants. We have to find another option, Aaron.
Aaron lifted both hands. Which is why I'm dressed for the road, he said. You want me to see how close I can get to Mastings? Tavi drew in a deep breath.
Sort of.
Aaron frowned and tilted his head.
I want you to get to Nasorg, Tavi said.
Aaron burst out in a laugh. It died young as he watched Tavi's expression.
Oh, he said. You were serious?
Yes. Aaron shook his head. Your confidence is flattering, but even if I could get close to him, which I don't think I could, I'm not at all sure I could take him. I saw him fight at the Elenarch.
No, no, crows, Tavi said. If I wanted him assassinated, I'd do it myself.
He paused to consider.
Or possibly send Max and Crassus.
For you, Aaron said. That was an uncommonly sensible afterthought. Tavi grinned at him for a second.
This isn't that kind of mission, Tavi said.
He flicked open the leather case on his sword belt and drew out a folded envelope. He offered it to Aaron. The young man stared at the envelope for a moment and exhaled slowly.
Oh, the other part of the cursor business.
He searched Tavi's face for a moment and said quietly,
We're messengers for the First Lord, Tavi. This isn't one of his messages. If he didn't want us using our initiative, he shouldn't be so hard to contact, Tavi replied.
Aaron chuckled.
Can't argue there.
What is it?
A request for a meeting, Tavi said, between me and Nasorg.
Aaron exhaled.
That's all?
Yes.
We don't really know how they're going to react to an official courier. No one's sent any.
Don't worry about it, Tavi said. You wouldn't be official.
Oh, Aaron said.
Crows.
You don't have to, Tavi said quietly. I can find something else for you to...
Oh, shut up, Aaron said, his voice annoyed, as he took the envelope from Tavi's hand.
You think Nasorg will be willing to talk?
If he is, Tavi said, I think we can expect him to behave in a civilized fashion.
They haven't exactly been a monolithic culture, Aaron replied. What if some of the other Khanim don't hold with Nasorg's way of thinking?
I'd advise you to avoid them, Tavi said.
You don't ask much, do you?
Aaron flashed Tavi an easy grin and slipped the envelope out of sight beneath his overlarge tunic.
Time limit?
Sooner is better, but take what you need to make the approach.
Tavi paused, then offered his hand again. Aaron took it, and Tavi said softly,
Be careful, Aaron.
Can't have you moaning over how guilty you feel for sending me off to my death, Aaron said, and winked at Kitai. The ambassador would never forgive me.
No, Kitai said. She stepped forward and kissed Aaron on the cheek.
I wouldn't. Walk softly.
I suspect I'll have less to worry about than you.
Take care of each other.
He nodded to them, turned, and vanished into the trees without ceremony. Tavi watched him go and bit his lip.
He knows what he is doing, Challa, Kitai said.
I know.
He knows the risks.
I know.
If this works, she said, what will you say to Nasorg? What do you hope to accomplish?
I don't know, Tavi said quietly. Yet. But I have to do something.
She stood beside him for a moment, then said, We should get back.
Tavi took a deep breath and blew it out again.
Right, he said. Lots to do. And we march at dawn.
Chapter 10. Just as Tavi rose to leave his office for the field, Araris shut the door and said in a very quiet voice, "I have to talk to you." There were 100 details still to take care of, and they formed a precise, clear list in the young commander's mind. Tavi buckled on his sword belt as he mentally ordered the list and reached for his cloak. "Fine. We can talk on the road." "No," the Singulare said quietly. Tavi threw his cloak around his shoulders. "The senator isn't going to appreciate it if we hold him up. Let's move." Araris looked steadily at Tavi for a second. Then he locked the door, folded his arms, and leaned back against it. "The senator," he said, "can wait." Tavi drew up short and stared at the older man until he had managed to shake the list out of the forefront of his thoughts. He studied Araris for a minute, taking in his wary posture, his obvious tension. Tavi concentrated for a moment and was able to feel a vague sense of unease, tinting an iron shell of resolve. "Oh," Tavi said quietly. "This talk." Araris nodded. "It's time." Boots thudded dully on the floors overhead, probably the sub-tribune's logistica moving the legion's treasury chest along with 2 full spears of guards.
"Why now?"
Araris nodded up at the world above.
"Because you're leaving on campaign. There's always the possibility that you might not come back from it. And because you're a grown man, Tavi. Because rumors are spreading and you've got to be ready. You need to know. You deserve to know."
Tavi felt a flash of old, hot frustration flare through him, but he pushed it back.
"I'm listening."
Araris nodded.
"There's a lot. Tell me what you've already worked out."
Tavi took a deep breath.
"I know," he said, "that you were a Singulare to the Princeps Gaius Septimus. I know that he died at the First Battle of Calderon 22 years ago. His Singulares were thought to have died with him. They were buried with him at the Princeps Memorium back in Calderon. I know," Tavi continued, "that you pledged your loyalty to me, that Gaius didn't seem to care for that, but that he kept you close to me for years." Araris nodded. "All true. I know that Aunt Isana doesn't talk about my mother much. Neither does Uncle Bernard."
Tavi glanced down. "The only thing they've ever said about my father is that he was a soldier." He tried not to let it happen, but his voice turned bitter.
"Which means I'm just a legionare's bastard. There are plenty of those around."
Araris looked up sharply.
"Bastard? No. No, your parents were wed, Tavi."
Tavi felt his heart begin to speed up. He'd spent a lifetime knowing almost nothing about his mother and father. No one had ever been willing to speak of them in anything but the vaguest terms. Tavi barely trusted himself to speak.
You knew them?"
Araris's eyes grew distant for a moment.
"Oh, yes," he said quietly. "Very well."
"How..." Tavi began, but his throat clenched shut.
"Who... what did..." Araris held up a hand. "First," he said, "I must tell you this. I did not want to be the one to speak. That duty by rights belonged to Isana. But she..."
He shook his head.
"When someone goes through as much grief and loss as she did, in such a short amount of time, it can leave wounds as surely as any sword. You can recover from some wounds, but sometimes they're lasting, crippling, and the best you can hope for is to survive them."
"I don't understand," Tavi said.
"Isana doesn't think very clearly where you are concerned. Not about this. She loves you desperately, Tavi."
Tavi chewed on his lip and nodded.
"I know. She's terrified of losing you. It clouds her judgment, I think, her resolve. I believe that she wanted to tell you the truth long before now. But she'd kept it locked up so tightly for so long, I'm not sure she knew how to let it out again."
Tavi shook his head.
"Wait. Araris, what truth?" "The truth about your father," Araris said quietly. "The truth about Gaius Septimus."
The bottom fell out of Tavi's stomach upon hearing the words. He'd known, no, not known, but speculated, analyzing what he knew and putting it together in a theory as the curses had trained him to do. It had been an idle exercise, or so he thought, though it might be more accurate to say that he had simply found a new way to daydream about what it would have been like actually to have parents in his life. He'd done that often as a child, spending hours picturing them, imagining what they might have looked like, sounded like, what they might have said, what life would have been like, how much better it might have been. Of course, the idea of the princeps, as Tavi's unknown father, had a single major stumbling block, the utter lack of fury craft that had haunted Tavi until 2 years before. But that wasn't an issue anymore. In fact, as he thought on it, it should have been more obvious to him. Tavi's crafting was still sharply limited by his lack of ability to control a manifest fury, but had he been in the academy, he would have earned 2 or 3 beads in every single branch of crafting by now. While it was not unheard of for a crafter, especially a scion of the citizenry, to be gifted in several areas of craft, it was exceedingly rare for anyone but the upper tiers of talent to possess skills that ran the entire spectrum of fury craft. It should have been more obvious, but he supposed it was possible he hadn't wanted it to be true. If Araris was correct, if the princeps truly was wed to his mother, it meant that he was a legitimate heir of the House of Gaius. It meant... bloody crows. It meant that the First Lord had an heir, and it was him, Tavi. Bloody crows. It meant that the most dangerous and ruthless people on the face of Karna were going to want him dead. Him. Tavi. Other pieces fell into place. He could see why Gaius had brought him to the academy, to give him a sound education, to expose him to the children of the citizenry. He'd been trained with the cursors, learning the arts of intrigue and deception. He'd been assigned to a room with Max, another outcast to Alaran High Society, just as Tavi himself was. That a friendship of mutual alliance would grow between them had been all but inevitable, and Tavi abruptly felt certain that Gaius had planned deliberately to secure Tavi at least one ally with the crafting power of a High Lord. And the First Lord's designs hadn't stopped there. Tavi had been sent out into a legion to learn the arts of strategy, tactics, logistics, and leadership. Granted, Gaius hadn't expected Tavi to wind up in command of the bloody thing, but the First Lord... his grandfather couldn't have been terribly displeased with the results. Gaius. His grandfather. He had a grandfather. Tavi knew he was breathing too quickly and it was making him dizzy, but too many thoughts were spinning through his mind to pay any attention. He wasn't sure if he wanted to scream, or hit something, or run, or laugh, or burst out weeping. His mind was an enormous blur of ideas and memories and possible futures, and only one thing was certain. Everything had changed. Everything. I've... Tavi swallowed and forced himself to stop stammering. I've known that there were things Aunt Isana wasn't telling me about my parents, but... Araris closed his eyes and sighed. Then he opened them and faced Tavi. No, Tavi. There's a lot your mother hasn't told you about your father. Tavi frowned and opened his mouth to ask another question, then stopped suddenly as he heard the very gentle emphasis Araris put on the word mother. A lot his mother hadn't told him. Not Aunt Isana. His mother. Isana. Isana was his mother. Tavi's heart suddenly throbbed and clenched, and the searing flame of shock and pain seared through his vitals. It was as if every tiny wound his heart had received over the years, every little momentary pain of a lonely child, every jab of self-loathing he felt when other children had asked who his parents were, every moment of longing for anything to fill that emptiness where his parents should have been, all of it came back to him at the same instant, in the same place, the concentrated heartache of a lifetime. Tavi turned his head and clutched a hand at his chest, fingers sliding over the plates of his armor. The pain wasn't physical, of course, but that made it no less real and no less terrible. Her sister was killed in the Marat attack at First Calderon.